Hello, everybody. I'm Brian Levine. Welcome to The Gould Standard, a podcast brought to you by the Glenn Gould Foundation. We bring you conversations with some of the most remarkable people from all across the world of the arts. If music, poetry, theater, film, painting, novels, or digital blockchain art are what draw you like a moth to a light bulb, come on in for a conversation that I'm sure you will find illuminating. Now, while you happen to be stopping under our neon sign, please do take a moment to press like, share, and subscribe. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please kindly leave your reviews or pose your questions and be part of our community of friends and supporters. And to get more simply wonderful words, images, and sounds, you can pay us a visit at our website, www.glenngould.ca. Today, I'm delighted to be welcoming an artist I've admired for many years, a man whose creativity really spreads out in almost every conceivable direction. He is among the most respected screen actors alive, but his accomplishments extend to painting, poetry, photography, music publishing, and more recently, film directing. He's a musician with 21 albums to his credit, including collaborations with the hugely versatile composer, songwriter, and multi-instrumentalist Buckethead. More than 15 books, including poetry and photography, and he has his own publishing house, which creates absolutely gorgeous books. And now, more recently, he directed his first film, Falling, in which he also stars. It's a tough, honest, and often uncomfortable film about a son's efforts to connect and reconcile with his bigoted father, who happens to be in the early stages of dementia. And, of course, for the legions of fans of J.R.R. Tolkien's epic fantasy, The Lord of the Rings, he will always be the king. Aragorn, son of Arathorn, Isildur's heir, and the High Lord of Gondor and Arnor. He also chaired the 2018 Glenn Gould Prize jury, which selected the great Jesse Norman as our laureate, and was master of ceremonies at her award ceremony and concert in Toronto the following year. Last year, he honored us by joining the board of the Glenn Gould Foundation. And of course, who could I be speaking of but the one, the only, Viggo Mortensen, who is joining us now today by Zoom. Viggo, welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's nice to see you.
It's great to see you. And where are you right now, and what are you working on at the moment?
In this year now, year plus of the pandemic, I haven't, like most people, been able to travel. And I suddenly find myself on the other side of the world. I'm in Sydney, Australia. I'm in confinement. They're very strict about their COVID procedures. They took a page from New Zealand's approach, and there's a good reason why in New Zealand and Australia there's practically no cases. The other day I read in the paper here that there was one case in Sydney, one person testing positive, and the alarm bells went off. What should we do? What should we do? And they did tracing, and they went to every single person that person had seen in probably the past week or so or more. And they test everyone. They really are going to, they're sparing no expense in those efforts. And when I arrived at the airport here, like anybody coming from outside of Australia, military police escort of a bus, you get on a bus and each person comes off individually and goes to specific hotels, a lottery where you end up. And they're polite, but they're very strict, and it takes hours before you actually set foot in your hotel room. And once you go in, you can't even set one foot outside in the hallway, nothing. There's a guard sitting there, polite, but there's someone on each floor, and they keep an eye on it, and nobody must leave the room for 2 weeks. And you send up food, you put out your trash, whatever, you're given some detergent, you have a small washing machine, you can wash your clothes. It's taxpayer expense, so it's, you can look at it and say, well, that's very expensive. That's crazy. We can't do that here. If you think about it, what they're doing is in the long run going to be a lot cheaper than what has happened in Canada, the US, Europe, most everywhere else in the world other than New Zealand and Australia, because it's a devastating impact on the economy. Yeah. The constant spikes in COVID and just businesses being shut down, all that. Here, I look out the window from my confinement and I see people walking arm in arm without masks. You saw anybody who's a tennis fan and saw the Australian Open. the end of January, I guess it was, people in the stands watching tennis, not wearing masks. Most of them, you can if you want to. It's not frowned upon, but it's not really necessary here. It's just quite, it's amazing what they're doing.
I think you're right. It's certainly cheaper than having, let's say, a quarter of all your small businesses go bankrupt. And I think that at a personal level, it seems to me that where we're living, and maybe in the U.S. and some other countries, we're like the mice behind the baseboard and the cat is prowling around outside. And every so often we stop hearing the cat. So we go out to check it out. And then a few of us get eaten and we scamper back in. And maybe the better idea is to stay inside behind the baseboard until the cat starves to death. And then we can come out.
That's a good idea. Yeah. It's what's happening most other places in the world is penny wise, pound foolish, I guess. But it's not just with COVID. This is an issue that's been political football in most countries for ages. Even in Canada, where there's a much better health care system for the whole country than there is in the US. It's more akin to what people have in Europe. But even so, it's a political football, and people are constantly saying, well, we should cut this, we should cut that. And prevention is the way, and that's what they're doing in Australia and New Zealand. Let's think ahead. Let's take a long view of it and do what makes sense. I would hope that most countries would learn from this pandemic, which won't be the last, that stinting on healthcare or running the healthcare system like a business, if it doesn't give a profit, we must privatize, we must cut this, cut that. I think there are certain things, education, culture, and certainly healthcare above all. If you don't have your health, you have nothing. Those things can't be run for profit. You can always make efforts to run it more efficiently, but I would hope that people would come to their senses about that. I don't think it will happen because politics will always come into play. But the result right now is that most countries are in disarray, understaffed, under-equipped. They're overrun in the hospitals. Concert halls are closed. Cinemas are closed. Theaters are closed. Museums are, by and large, closed. Some places they open against the better judgment of the experts, science, medicine, and it is what it is. We have a chaotic situation. Here, I think they're doing something different, which I admire, and I don't mind being confined. I accept it and I understand. I'll be here 2 weeks. I'm a week into it, and I'm okay with it. I'm happy to be on my own. I have time to rethink.
I think you're right about all of that. I think we all long for the day when we have politicians who have enough leadership and enough commitment to the public good that when they come under pressure from lobbies and interest groups and think tanks and so on, they basically check their inner barometer about what's right for the public, which starts with them surviving and having a decent standard of living and decent security and healthcare and so on. And then they basically turn to those interest groups and pressure groups and give them the middle finger. And speaking of deft segues, David Cronenberg in Falling, speaking of the middle finger, I thought that was actually just far enough removed that I could make that segue. But anyway, I did want to talk a little bit about Falling because it really is a remarkable film. It was very shattering, but it stayed with me a long time. And of course, there's a certain shock value because Lance Henriksen's character, Willis, says horrible, shocking things. And you're also dealing with the very dramatic situation of a very self-reliant individual who's being forced to confront or trying to deny confronting his own mortality and the loss of himself through dementia. There are so many layers and nuances to the film. It's tremendously thoughtful film, and you're wonderful in it. Your direction is wonderful. The music is wonderful. I'm taking on myself the role of reviewer to say everyone who hasn't seen it, go see it. But one of the things that really struck me about it is what a study in contrasts it is. There's a very powerful urban-rural contrast. John is living in Los Angeles and living a much more refined and less rustic life than his father, who's in an upstate New York farm where he raised the family. You've got, obviously, a gay-straight divide between the father and the son. You've got some political differences, to put it mildly. And I know you've said that there are elements of your own family life and experience in this? Where do those dividing lines fall in terms of how you ultimately drew the balancing lines between the fact and the fiction in the film?
Well, it was a story that I started writing right after my mother's funeral. She had dementia for several years before she passed away. She also had Parkinson's. And dementia is something that's my family has a lot of history with that, both sides of my family. My father's from Denmark and family there, uncles, grandparent, aunt, a couple uncles with it. Then my father got it after my mother also. And on my mother's side, a lot of people too. So it's something I was familiar with. And after her funeral, as happens when someone that you're close to passes, the image of them, their words, the sound of their voice, their smell, everything about them is very present. You're looking at photographs, perhaps videos, you're looking at things they wrote, finding letters. And so they're very present. And with the passing of time after a funeral for someone you care about, those things fade a little bit, in at least in their immediacy, of how they impact you on an emotional level on a day-to-day basis. That's natural, just like the memory of the pain of breaking your leg or something, it fades. Your mind protects you in that sense. And I didn't want it to fade. So I started writing these things down, everything I could remember, everything I personally could remember about her, the things I'd heard at the funeral, stories about her, different versions of the stories that I knew well from people that were at the funeral, which I thought was interesting, that sort of Rashomon thing where everybody's recollection is different, how subjective memory is. I thought that was interesting. So I started writing these things down, not intending to try to make a movie of it. In fact, I was trying to make a movie from a different screenplay at the time. And I had at that point been trying for 20 plus years to direct a movie from something I'd written. I'd written several screenplays. So I was in the middle of trying to get another story made, completely different story. And I got home. And a few days later, I thought, maybe I'll look at these notes, look at my notebook. What did I write down about my mother? And I looked at it because what I ended up doing as I was writing these notes, it was a long plane trip. I started putting it in. I thought, well, this would be a good story. All these jumps in time and different recollections that people have and these tensions within any family, I suppose. And the issue of dementia, how that affects memory, perception. And I wrote a story that was fictional, really, using these feelings about my mom. And I just put it aside because I had other things, including try to keep making that other movie happen. And a few days later, I read it. I looked at it thinking, it's probably not going to be that great. So you wake up in the middle of the night and you hear some music and you write down an idea, you know, for a song or a piece of music or a poem, or just, this would make a great story. You scribble it down. You look at it the next day thinking, well, that's going to be special. And you look at it over breakfast and generally disjointed, it's not very good. That's what I find anyway. Those things that you write down in the middle of the night thinking, oh, that's genius. I can't wait to look at that after my coffee. And it's generally nothing to it, really. It's not very original. And in this case, I liked it. I liked the structure a lot. And I thought, this is promising. And I can picture these memory fragments. It's very visual. And maybe it's not a novella or a short story. Maybe it's a movie. So in my spare time and evenings, I started writing it out as a screenplay. I was able to write that quite quickly, much faster than any other screenplay I'd written. And when the other project fell apart, I couldn't raise the money, as it happened so many times over the years. I tried to get this one done. And it took me about 4 years to get it made. But I did find Lance Henriksen very early on. I did have my cinematographer, Marcel Ziskin, Danish cinematographer, really good. Carol Spear from Canada, production designer I'd worked on Cronenberg movies with. And so we had a little nucleus. And I just kept trying to raise the money. It took a while, but if you want to watch it, you can find it in Canada, US, anywhere pretty much now, almost. It's basically that short story. It's the same essential structure, the same themes, and with a great central performance by Lance Henriksen, one that he remembered, I think, for a long time.
Absolutely.
I feel he hasn't gotten the credit he ought to have. You know, he's had recognition, reviews and audience reactions when I presented the movies have been extraordinary, especially towards his performance. But just the times we're in, you know. He's a difficult character. He's hard to take, some of the things he says, but in his extraordinary layered performance, I don't know if it wasn't an 80-year-old white man, perhaps he would have gotten to be on more on some of the experts' lists of great performances this year. I would put his performance up against anyone's this year.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that a part of it is it's a bit of a departure for him in terms of a lot of the other roles that he's associated with. But the other thing about it, and I think this may be part of the story, is this film deals with a whole variety of different discomfort zones. And one of them is this divide between saying really awful and, for most of us, offensive and unacceptable things. And as good liberals, we're supposed to basically say they're deplorables and we will have nothing left to do with them. But your character, John, really, despite whatever hurt and rage he manages, he may feel, he suppresses it and keeps trying and trying to forge or reforge that connection with his father.
There are lots of people like that. There are lots of family conflicts. If you're a younger person looking at this movie and looking at the character that Lance Henriksen plays, Willis, if you're young and maybe you haven't had to care for one of your parents or grandparents, or I don't know, it may be easier to say, when someone talks to me like, that's it, I'm done.
Yep.
It's a lot easier said than done in some cases. The case in this story, and I don't like movie stories or any kind of art that tells you what to think. I'm not a big fan of, you know, agitprop or propaganda type art. I think, you know, I like to respect the audience's intelligence, and you can do whatever you want. In this case, the character I play, the son of Willis, I know that this man needs help. Mentally and physically. I also know that if he's going to accept any help at all from anyone, and he might not in the end, it's probably only going to be from me. And the only way I'm going to keep that connection, tenuous as it may be most of the time, and that communication, the line of communication open with my father in this story, is by swallowing a lot of horrible treatment, behavior, language. He makes a conscious choice. He even talks about it early in the story. There's a scene, a lengthy scene, where the father is really being abusive. It's late at night. It's a combination of his dementia, but also of his instinctive shoot first, ask questions later attitude toward life and people. If I'm not sure that you're offending me, I'm going to assume you are. And I'm going to attack you. That's the best defense is a good offense. That's what he, you know, and it's just invective after invective, homophobic statements, racist, whatever he can do to provoke me. And I can't be completely sure. Is he doing this intentionally? Is he confused? Is this a dementia? In any case, if I want to keep the line of communication open and get him to accept some help from me, I'm going to have to take it. And that's a choice that he makes, and he hangs in there. Most of the story, at a certain point, the son cannot bear it anymore. And mostly it has to do with the way the father talks about the mother. More so than the homophobic statements, the racism and the general misogyny and intolerance, it's the memory of the mother that really, it gets to him, how she's spoken about. And that was... The mother is, in a way, even though it's not, played by Hannah Gross, brilliant Canadian actress, she does a beautiful job. And even though she's not in the movie all the time, for me, she's the moral fulcrum, the conscience of the piece, in a way. And after all, the story, even though it's fictional, is based on my feelings and and memories of my own mother. So that's the issue in the end. But in terms of storytelling, that's... It's an intentional, unusual way to create dramatic tension for a long time, where not a conflict at the center of that tension in the normal sense, where two people are battling, but one person's attacking, the other person's evading, changing the subject, resisting the temptation to respond in kind and so forth, until they can't anymore. There's a tensing of this until it just breaks. And that was the storytelling approach, but it was also what I felt was the right thing in that relationship.
Yeah, it absolutely builds to a really powerful climax. And while some people may have been sitting, waiting, cheering, wondering when it was going to happen, at the end of it, it doesn't feel like finally he gives the old coot a bit of his own back. It's really what needs to happen in order to achieve some resolution. And for me, Willis is continually provoking John. But that feels a little bit like a fear reaction. He knows at some level that essentially parts of him are disappearing. And it seems to me like a desperate plea to say, I'm still here, damn it. And if I get you to respond and react, there's an affirmation.
I'm alive.
Yeah, I'm alive still. Yeah.
A lot of things. Yeah. So no, Lance really went for it. What's great about Lance's work in this, he would always say to me, don't let me get caught acting. I said, I don't think I will, the way we're going. and I didn't. And he wanted to live it. He didn't want to. There are other performances I've seen, including this year, without naming names, but where dementia is depicted. And it's more of a performance. And in some cases, there's an obvious, to me, as an actor, I see an obvious effort to ingratiate oneself with the audience. Like clowning around, doing, I'll show you all these things I can do, all this skill set I have technically as an actor and all that. But the difference is that what Lance is doing is life, giving you a life uncompromisingly. It's brutal at times, but there are so many fine layers in there. There's so much. You can see the insecurity. You can see the fear, not to excuse anything, but you can see it. He's a human. He's a real human being.
Yep.
This is it.
Exactly.
All my flaws. This is me. Rather than let me see what can I do here to get your attention as an audience. So there's a consistency. There's also the issue with dementia, you know, from my long experience with it in my family, in depictions of that ailment that I find troubling and most other depictions of it in plays and movies I've seen about it, which is that they depict someone who's, generally speaking, confused. And if they try to show their point of view, it's a confused point of view. And my experience is that it's the caretaker, the observer, the caregiver, who is generally more confused. Those people, once they're in that place, they're seeing and hearing and remembering these things. It's real. It's not, unless you disturb that by correcting them and saying, you know, that person you said you just had lunch with died 30, 40 years ago. Then they will be confused and upset. But otherwise, they're generally not confused. And that's what I wanted to show with Lance, not just hoping that he would give a great performance, which he does. He goes beyond anything I expected. But the use of what you can do in film, how you can use images and sound and where it's placed, music to some degree, to create this alternate present that they're living in.
All I can say is, bravo. Direct another one soon, please. Yeah. As far as I'm concerned, if I had a great big checkbook, I'd be writing you a check. I'd like to shift gears and talk a little bit about your early life, since in a way, Falling takes you back into that territory to some extent, because it seems to me that your childhood was an unusual mix of cosmopolitanism and small-town American life, all rolled into one. Let me see if I have this right. You were born in Watertown, upstate New York.
No? I was born in New York City. And, the events that you see that are combination rural and that you see in the movie are, there are some things taken and you know, sort of flashbacks, the whole duck story that sort of could be a short movie on its own. That serves to introduce the family, the fate of this duck and what happens with it. Those are taken from real memories, but they didn't happen in North America. They happened in South America. When I was an infant, my dad got a job in South America. First decade of my life, I spent largely down there in Argentina. 1 year in Venezuela that I don't remember, but the rest in Argentina. But the duck story, that happened, but it happened down there.
Ah, that's really interesting. So essentially, you were brought up at the beginning almost as a South American boy, speaking Spanish. Was Spanish your first language, or was it a parallel track linguistically?
The first words I heard from my mother were in English. She's American. My dad's Danish. But very quickly, I was immersed in Spanish. And so, you know, they were parallel as I was growing up. And my two younger brothers were raised from the get-go down there. And so we, the three of us, until we left, when my parents split up and went back to actually the area where falling takes place, northern New York State, up near the Canadian border, across from Lake Ontario and St. Lawrence River, that area, we only spoke Spanish together. I remember when we were traveling north with my mother, when I was just about 11 and they were 8, 6, we were speaking Spanish. And I kept saying to them, especially to the youngest who refused to speak English, even though he understood it, I said, we're going to have to speak English when we get there because our cousins and the other people, they're not going to understand you in Spanish. And I know you can understand it. So we got to do that. And so we made that transition as kids do quite quickly. But since I was older, language, culture, some of those things were already embedded in me from Argentina and stayed with me ever since, in a way, perhaps a little more than they have their memories, but there was an imprint on me that was stronger just because I was older.
I would think that just, for example, in my own experience in South America versus the general reserve of North Americans, the openness of expression, less demand for physical space, a greater readiness for emotional intimacy, and you find yourself not too far from the frosty Canadian border, and people are a little bit more backed off. Also, you were in Argentina. I'm sure that you were too young to appreciate it at a time of real political ferment.
No, I remember. I mean, I was old enough. I remember before the years of dictatorship in the 70s, there were things like that happening in the 50s and 60s. But I remember the late 60s, President Onganía was president. And he was a military person. There was essentially that was a dictatorship as well. It didn't become as extreme in terms of the people tortured and killed and disappeared.
Yes, yeah, that's another difference. A sense of kind of pervasive anxiety, maybe not as bad as when Perón came back for his third term, if there's the potential of political violence. Of course, some of that's now come home.
But as a kid, that's life. You don't think that it's unusual. It's only looking back at it that I appreciate that aspect. But the immediate effect when we moved up to the Canadian border, basically, to be with my mother's side of the family, where we lived for a while at the grandparents' house until she made her own way and remarried and all that. The immediate things that I remember were sort of cultural differences, where in Argentina, even more than in Spain, men will kiss each other and embrace and even walk down the street arm in arm, and that's not so unusual. There's an Italian influence and other things, but. And I find myself having to stop myself as a kid from hugging other boys and things like that. And there was just a different, less tactile interaction socially. And so with that, you adjust quickly as a kid. But I noticed that.
Yeah, a couple of bloody noses will get you that.
What are you doing? Let go of me.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I realized it quickly. We had visited a few times during the first decade of my life. I remember going back with my mother. She went back when she was about to give birth to each of my brothers. So they were born in the U.S. But yeah, I knew a little bit. And I knew how my mother was. But my mother was quite affectionate. She was tactile. So it fit in the way things were in Argentina. Anyway, that was a big difference, just the way things were in the U.S., the way people interacted. There was a certain formality in terms of physically. But there was an informality in terms of language.
And I've read that your mother's mother, your maternal grandmother, was from Nova Scotia originally. Is that true?
No, her grandfather, Walter. His name was Walter Atkinson. Yeah, he was from Nova Scotia.
Okay. Then I'm laying the groundwork for claiming you as a closet Canadian, especially since you're wearing that T-shirt. But your love of the Habs is well documented.
I'm happy to be adopted by Canada. But no, I'm always, not just that my grandfather was from there, but I've been living across the border and going there a lot during my adolescence. I got to know where people were and the landscapes, and I liked it. And then as a young adult, and since then, I've crisscrossed Canada many times. I've worked there as an actor. I've crossed Canada by train, by car, more than once. Not quite as many times as if I've done the United States, but I do know where the capital of Canada is. I know that they are provinces and not states and territories.
Yes.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of Americans that don't know those things, but which is strange.
Yeah, it's, you know, when you're the big dog, you don't have to take as much notice of the little dog, even if the big the little dog is geographically bigger. But in going through this line of conversation, I've been trying to get to the lead up of what made you first think about becoming an actor. So let me just say, after you graduated from college, you spent some time in Europe, odd-jobbing it. Would that be right?
Yeah, I had, even during college, I had a really strong connection always with the Danish side of the family, my cousins there. I love my cousins in the United States. I have a good relationship with them. But there was something about, and maybe Denmark's a little different than Sweden and Norway, generalization, but sometimes people jokingly call Denmark the Italy of the North or something. People are very warm, and they can be. There's a lot of embracing and hugging, and people can be a little more open about their emotions. Not everyone, but my cousins certainly were that way. And so whenever we visited them from time to time, summers or sometimes for Christmas, I would always have a great connection with them. And the language barrier sort of disappeared quickly, and it was just, we had a lot of fun. So I went there once I had a choice. Once I was an adult, I would go there a lot, and I would work. And during my university years, summers, I spent there working and living there. And then as soon as I finished, I moved there because I felt good being there. And
It's beautiful. I remember back when I was in the record business, we had a distributor for our record label in Denmark, and he said, "We're not like the other Scandinavians. We used to be Vikings. That means that we weren't good at bottling it up. We like to drink and rampage and say rude things."
Yeah, culturally, you can see that in some of the TV series that come out of there. They're very well written. There's a high level, technically, in terms of directors, performers. A country of between 5 and 6 million people, but they produce an inordinate amount of really good television and film and theater. Storytelling is really important there. It's very much a part of the culture, I think. It is most places, but it's as important as sport or anything else.
Absolutely.
There. So yeah, I like movies. I like going to the theater. I had always been intrigued by movie storytelling, but I never imagined that I would be part of that. That was given to me by my mother, really. First time I went to a movie house, I was about 3, when that was in Argentina. And all through those years in Argentina, my mom took me constantly. She'd say, "You want to go to the movies?" "Yeah." You know, rainy day, or she'd get me to school. And we saw a lot of movies, and movies that were for adults. And we had great conversations. I can remember them. The first one I really remember seeing all the way through and having a long conversation with my mom about was Lawrence of Arabia, for example.
Oh, wow.
I would have been 4. And at that time, there's still a couple left, but at that time, there was a street in Buenos Aires where there were about 20 giant movie houses, and some of them had seating for 2,000 people, and they were grand movie houses. And I saw all the big Argentine movies and British movies, European ones, and any decent U.S. movie. My mom would go see it, and I would go see them with her, and we'd have conversations about it. It all seemed normal to me, like anything does as a kid. And then when I grew up, I realized, most moms don't do that. Conversations, as if a couple of screenwriters are talking. She would talk about what wasn't in the movie or what the music did at that point. Or, "I know he was feeling that, but he didn't say it. Didn't you think that was interesting?" And those kinds of conversations.
Amazing. And remarkable that the first you remember is Lawrence of Arabia. If someone had tapped you on the shoulder as a little boy and said, "X years from now, you're going to be sitting across from that man, Omar Sharif, in a tent acting with him," that would have probably blown your mind.
Yeah, I would have thought, "Oh, wow." But my mom was smitten with Omar Sharif. She wasn't generally a movie fan that was into the stars. She was into the stories. That's what we talked about. But Omar Sharif had a special place, I think, in her fantasy life, or I don't
yes.
know what. You know, when we saw that movie, and then also Dr. Zhivago, she went on and on about it.
Oh, yeah.
And, there was an interesting, great thing that happened was the movie I worked with Omar in was called Hidalgo, and he played this sheikh, and I was a cowboy who went to compete in this long desert horse race. And when we had the premiere, it was in on Hollywood Boulevard, one of those big old movie theaters there. I invited my mom and my stepdad were out visiting, and I said, well, let's go. We can come to the premiere of this movie. And so they came, and it was, big event. I had talked to Omar during the shoot about my mom being fascinated with him and how I had these memories of seeing him on screen when I was a little boy, and that I had admired his work since then and all that. But I talked a lot about my mother. And so when he showed up, I was standing talking with my mother outside the theater just before the premiere was about to start, and I saw him, and then he pointed, he's like, is that her? And I said, and so he came over and he walked right up to her, which sort of startled my stepfather. He was like, who's this man? What's he doing? And he said, you must be Grace. And then he took her hand and raised it, looking, never taking his eyes away from hers, and kissed it, but didn't quite touch his lips. Yes. On her hand. It was like, yes, very, very elegant, correct. And then he said, it's a pleasure to meet you. And she couldn't even talk. And then, he said, Vigo, I'll see you in there. I said, yes, thank you. Nice to see you, Oma. And walked away, and my stepdad was like, smoke was coming out of his ears. What the hell? Who's that? What's going on here? It was an interesting closing of a circle.
But also, what a gracious thing for him to do. And he strikes me as someone who grew from a very intense person to a very sweet-natured person over the course of his life. Although, of course, being a fine actor, you could never really tell.
He was always had a certain elegance about him, but he was a bad boy too. He would, if he had a few drinks in him, he could be belligerent and always witty, but sometimes he could be a bit cutting, a bit cruel, right, I suppose. And I saw that sometimes. He had a regimen, which is interesting. He wouldn't eat anything all day long. When we were shooting out in the desert, he might have a glass of water, but even that, he wouldn't have anything, breakfast, lunch, or anything. And then when we finished shooting, he would have a couple of scotches. He'd go down to the bar and have a couple of, whiskeys. And then dinner, and he'd want people to be there. He'd invite people for dinner all the time. And after a while, I was like, I can't do this every night. But I did a few times. And he would keep drinking whiskey and then wine and come on, more. And he would be telling these amazing stories all through dinner. But by the end of dinner, he could get caustic.
Yeah. You returned from Europe to America. And I am guessing that somewhere around the time you got back, acting was on your radar. What put the idea in your head, aside from your fondness for movies through your mother? And how did you get connected to the point where you could actually get cast in insignificant films?
The reason I decided to give it a try, going from just an audience member who was interested in movie stories to being entertained, going from that to actually wondering how it was done, how was the illusion created? That started to happen when I was in Europe and I started going to movie houses that would show, art houses. Art houses where there'd be two different movies on each night. They change every day or every couple of days, and you'd see another couple. And that's when I started seeing more. I started learning about the history of cinema more prior to when I started at age three watching movies and whatever I'd seen on television and so forth. Seeing Asian movies, seeing early Bergman and Visconti and Ozu and Bresson and all the great filmmakers, Tarkovsky films, and just really seeing the wide range of storytelling. And I was, at some point I was struck by this idea of being transported. How does that happen that I step out of a movie theater and I'm shocked that it's raining and I'm in a city and it's night. It's not daytime in a desert or on the Russian steppes or something. There's something, and how is it that I'm so moved and driven to think about my own family and personal relations, and that at least for a moment, when it really works, the storytelling and the acting, I'm inspired to rethink where I am and what's going on and what I've done so far in my life and what I'd like to do now, even driven at times. I should call this person. I haven't talked to him for a long time. This has affected me. I think we could make up. Just these things that good stories can do for you. Music can do the same thing, obviously. And so I decided to try it, and I didn't know how to do it, but I moved from Denmark, I was living at the time, to a city, because the person I was in a relationship with at the time went there. So I followed her. And I started, how does one do that? So I essentially looked in the Yellow Pages. It's like, well, theaters, and how do you try out for a play and so forth. And so I called one of them. It had a nice name. It's Actors Repertory Theater. Well, that sounds good. They do lots of plays, probably. I didn't know it was a theater workshop. Yeah, they did do plays once in a while, but it's essentially a school, right? And so I called them on the phone. I said, what's the play? And they said, what are you talking about? And I said, what can I try out? What are you doing? And I said, well, yes, anyone can try out. You can come in next Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. and bring two pieces. And I said, two pieces of what? And they said, memorize two texts and come in and perform that. And we'll see whether we have room for you or not. And they still hadn't told me what the play was. But I thought, okay. So I found two things and something. One was just Karen Blixen, Isaac Dinas in short story that features Jack the Ripper. And so I just culled bits of dialogue from the story that he spoke, and I made this monologue from that. And then for some reason, there was an old traditional Irish song that I knew that had to do with Irish, young Irishmen being conscripted by the British army and forced to go on pain of death to join the army, basically, and fight for the empire. And so I performed this odd monologue I'd cobbled together and sang the song, and probably wasn't what they were expecting, but they thought there was something there. So they said, you can come and you can be part of the class. But what's the play? It says, there is no play. There's a class. There's a workshop, and you can come next week and start, and it costs this much money and so forth. And so, you know, I was like most actors, I was working odd jobs to pay the rent and now to pay for these classes and moving furniture, bartender, selling ice cream on the street, whatever, odd jobs. And so that's where I started. And because it was anonymous, I didn't know any of these people in the class. I felt if it doesn't work, I'll just try something else. So I just started, but it kept my interest, even though it took a long time, many years before I could make a living from it. I did hundreds of auditions, but I liked the process. Each audition taught me something, taught me to be flexible. Each casting director, each director, each, you know, text. And I was lucky in the sense that right off the bat, I would progress, call back auditions to the point where it'd be leading roles in movies and sometimes TV shows. It'd be between me and another person. But I never got those roles. It's frustrating, but it was still interesting enough to me. The more I learned about the storytelling aspect of it, the more I liked it. I'd always liked it. But now I was seeing how you created the illusion. And I liked it. I liked the process, even though I wasn't getting anywhere. And my mom always supported me in that regard. My dad was more practical and said, you don't seem to be able to make a living from this. So maybe you should try something else. Or maybe you should put on a tie. What's your next tryout? I said, it's called an audition and it's for a serial killer. And I don't think wearing a suit and tie would really... Well, it's always good to wear a tie. So I stopped talking to him about it, you know, telling him what I was doing. But my mom was very interested, and she knew a lot. She would often would know who the director was and what they had done. And she was like a film historian in a way. And who else is in it? I said, I don't know, Mom. I don't know much about it. I've just been given these sides, these scenes. I don't even know the whole story. Well, and how are those scenes? And it was just like annoying in a way, but it was very supportive. And she never questioned I should stick with it. And I think she probably would have been a good actress had things been different in her life, but she was very interested in it. When I started getting attention, I'm not someone who wins awards, but I have been nominated. And one of those times, the first time it really happened was a movie I did with David Cronenberg, one of the Eastern Promises. And one of those events, the Screen Actors Guild, I invited her to go. She was my date. And there's one of these things where they have tables and you're eating and watching the award show and participating in it. And that was fantastic because she would see these older actors or directors, actresses, movie personalities, and she would almost always know who they were. Oh, that's so and so. He directed that movie. And or that's her. She used to be married to him and she did the one good job. And she would say, oh, that's John Travolta. And she goes, excuse me. And she'd get up and go over and talk. All night. It was nerve-wracking. I said, what's he going to do? And she would get over to that person's table and
right.
back at me sitting there at the table going,
yeah.
son.
Yeah. And you're like, wondering, is this the end of my career?
Yeah, no, this guy felt like the kid who's suddenly at a certain point in grade school, they start to want to pretend like they don't have parents by the parents driving them to school or walking them to school. And I felt a little of that, but I also felt really good because I knew she was having a great time. I wish I'd been able to do that more with her. She became sick and couldn't really participate in those sort of things. She got to experience that.
That's great.
Up close, that world that she'd so her whole life been fascinated
by. Exactly. Now, your first breakthrough was a non-breakthrough because you got cast in Purple Rose of Cairo, but you ended up on the cutting room floor, I understand. So no one's ever seen that. What did you do in that?
I enjoyed that a lot, and I liked working for Woody Allen. I think he's one of the greats. And yeah, I was cast. Well, he's notorious for not really saying much to the actors. And even in the audition process, you generally walk in and he doesn't say anything. He just looks at you for a minute or so and then says, thank you for coming in. And that's it. He just wants to look at you and see if you would fit the character. And, you know, that's it. And his casting director, I remember before going in his office in New York City, Juliet Taylor, she said, now don't be alarmed if it's over very quickly. It's not personal. This is the way it always is. I said, okay. So I walked in his office, sitting there, and he looks at me. He didn't say anything. He's just looking at me up and down. And I looked at a chair, and he didn't say sit down, but I decided to sit down. And after a long, long silence, he's just looking at me and observing me, like, you know, scrutinizing me as if I was some kind of specimen. Not rudely, just doing what he does, I guess. And I said, hello, finally. And he nodded and looked at me a little more, and he might have smiled. And then after a bit, it seemed very long. It was probably only a couple minutes.
Yeah.
It seemed a very long time. He said, well, thank you for coming in, which I knew was my cue to leave. And so I got up and said bye and left, and that was it. And I thought, well, that was a disaster probably. And no, he apparently, the word I got the next day from my agent, he really liked you and he wants you to be in this movie. I said, okay, what's the part? Said, you'll find out, I guess, when you get there. It's, you know, I had no idea. So I got there, some mansion out in Long Island, and it took trains, buses, whatever to get there. And there was a lot of people there. It was a big cocktail Hollywood party scene. And I had very, really long hair at that time. And the first thing I did is just cut it all off and greased my hair and made me look like an actor from the 1920s, gave me a suit. And I said, what am I supposed to do? And they said, what do you mean? I said, well, you'll be called when it's time for you to do your scene. I said, what is my scene? I have no idea. Oh, but Mr. Allen will explain that to you. And so I'm just looking at the people's clothing and looking at my own. I said, okay, so this seems to be 1920s, maybe 1930s, early 30s, from the costumes and the decor. Okay. And finally, at one point, after a couple hours, I said, okay, you're up, Mortensen. Boom. So I walked in and it was all cameras. Everything was all set up and they had obviously been prepping this and they were about to shoot. And there was a lot of people in this cocktail party with their sort of drinks and all that. And a lot of beautiful women and all kinds of stuff and fancy dress. And Woody Allen was talking to this other young actor about my age and some whispering in his ear. And the actor was nodding. And then Woody Allen said, okay, let's try one. And I said, well, Mr. Allen, what do you want me to do? He says, what do you mean? I said, what are we doing? And he said, you just react to him, okay? And I said, okay. And sound, action. And the guy comes over and he asked me, so what was it like to work on the DeMille picture? So I just made something up. I said, I just decided the way I felt was like a dumb actor who didn't really know what the hell he was doing. So I spoke, I said, I spoke about, yeah, it was like exhausting. I was up on this sort of stump with this crossbar and I had my arms and I was wearing like this diaper and I had this weird hat that was made of like thorns and stuff. And, you know, there's this like Roman soldier poking with a stick. And it was just, I got sunburned, and as you can see, and it was grueling. I don't know. In other words, the actor was playing Jesus Christ. And that, of course, that amused Woody Allen, maybe being Jewish and so forth. He thought that was great. And he was laughing and laughing. I said, oh, he really liked it. And then he said, let's do one more. And I said, what do you want me to do now? He goes, we'll do more or less the same thing. That works. And so I did a variation on that, elaborated a little more, and it became more ridiculous, of course. And I'd never seen that footage, but I heard the next day that he was really happy with it. It was really made his day. And I said, oh, great. And my agent said, that's really good. That's rare. So then, of course, I told my mom, first and foremost, you know, how it went. And then she kept nagging me for the rest of the year. When's it coming out? When's it coming out? And then finally I said, it's coming out next Friday. Go see it. And she went to see it. And of course, I wasn't in it. I wasn't in the credits. And she called me and accused me of lying to her that I hadn't actually been in a movie. And what was I doing down there? This happened to me in another movie as well, with Jonathan Demme, Swing Shift. And same thing. I had a dialogue scene. Very nice one. Goldie Hawn. It was cut out. So this happens more often than not. And sometimes you're told, usually you're not, that you're not in it. And that's the way it goes. So it was a long apprenticeship, which is probably good for me. Yep. I'm a late-blooming, slow learner. I got to learn by being on some shoots, playing small parts, many auditions. And I learned the ropes, watching how crews work together, you know, how the cinematographer and the director talk. I saw examples of bad communication with crews. And you see the end result, and usually the better movies are the ones where there's been good communication and preparation. And so that's what I learned over the years. I started making a living. Right.
But you also had the opportunity to work with a lot of really major directors during that time, Jane Campion and Brian De Palma, Ridley Scott, Gus Van Sant, just to name a few. And although they're not all big roles, certainly G.I. Jane, that's a pretty big role. In fact, that is really the number two role in the film after Demi Moore. But you certainly must have seen a lot of different approaches to storytelling and to working with crews and working with casts. And that, I'm guessing that you filed that all away, and that by the time you came to Falling, you had a pretty well-charged memory bank of ideas on how to make it all work.
Yeah, that was very helpful, all of that. Much as I wanted to, the first time I tried to get a movie made, it was 25 years ago, that I wanted to direct. And I had already had some of those good experiences, and I might have done okay, but I learned a lot more years after first attempt, failed attempt. And by the time I got to direct Falling, I had the benefit of learning from all these people and good models. And it was about how to prepare, primarily, to get rid of as many stumbling blocks and possible problems before you start shooting. But also, most importantly, how do you communicate with the crew and with the actors? What's the most efficient way? And the one thing that all these good directors I've worked with have in common, men and women from different places who have different impulses, different styles, and so forth. What's consistent about them is that they're not afraid of suggestions, ideas, questions from their crew and cast. They don't take offense. They see what they can use. It's like anything that can help me make a better story, it's all to the good. Bring it on. So that's the way I approached Falling. And we had a great crew. And I said that the first day. I said, what I've learned from the best directors is that a good idea can come from any one of you at any time. Don't be shy, because you're only going to help. We have a very short time. We have one crack at telling the story. And if you have a great idea today, don't mull it over and tell me tomorrow, because it'll be too late. You can't go back and shoot today's scene. We don't have that kind of budget. So, and people, they obliged, and they came with lots of good ideas. And one, the most helpful thing was, maybe it's partly because they were given that green light to communicate with me and with anybody all the time, is that they started sharing stories about their own family dynamics that related to our story. They related in a personal, sometimes very emotional way, to the scenes we were playing out, that we were putting together as a team. They would relate to Lance Henriksen's character, or the difficulty of communication with someone who has dementia, or ideological rifts that you have in families, polarization that happens in some families, and how do you rebuild those bridges, or maybe you never can. And it was That was really helpful, just knowing that everybody on board, it was more than just a job for the crew. So that was wonderful.
And it must have been great validation, the sense that you knew you were onto something because you were touching chords with the life experiences of people you were actually working with. In that period, there are two films that you appeared in that really stand out for me, outliers in a way, and those are the two you made with Philip Ridley, The Reflecting Skin and The Passion of Darkly Noon. First of all, because that's two-thirds of his entire cinematic output, so that is quite a place, but also he's another artist who does a great many things, very difficult to pigeonhole, in many ways difficult to categorize films. What were those experiences like?
I really enjoyed working with Philip. His first full-length feature was The Reflecting Skin, which was shot in Alberta. That would have been the summer of 89, I believe. And I think the movie didn't come out until 1991, but I think it went to the Cannes Film Festival. He'd been and written some children's stories that were disturbing, but really original. And I liked his approach. It was an unusual approach to filmmaking. You know, he didn't know as much, say, at that point anyway, about the technology, the camera, and you know, all the tools of filmmaking as, say, someone like David Cronenberg does. But he had a knack for storytelling, and he had his particular style. And I got along with him quite well, and so I was happy to repeat with him when we did The Passion of Darkly Noon. But these were difficult movies for him to get financed. It was a very unusual story. And then he did do a third one, as you say. But unfortunately, he's one of those filmmakers that you wish would get to make more movies. I'm sure he would have liked to. But he's written for the theater, and I've seen some of his plays. And he's a good writer. He's a very thoughtful person, a very sensitive person. Real iconoclast, and I wish he'd get to direct more movies. Hopefully he will again. He's different from all the other directors I've worked with, but a kind person.
Yeah, and you sense that about him, that he came from a pretty rough part of London, probably didn't have a lot of advantages, but managed to turn that into a very perceptive, very penetrating art that is sometimes very disturbing. And by the way, all the best children's books are disturbing, from Brothers Grimm to Roald Dahl.
They Chris really Anderson.
Are. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I used to go into fits over The Little Match Girl when I was growing up. But anyway, we really need to take a few minutes to talk about Lord of the Rings. It was inevitable. But also, even though it's something that is a huge milestone in your career, and there's always this, you'll never be pigeonholed because your work is so varied, but it is something that stands in people's mind. And it was a huge commitment of time for you, making these three mammoth films. How did Peter Jackson come to cast you as Aragorn? Had you read Tolkien before?
I had not read Tolkien before, and I'd heard about it. I'd heard about The Hobbit, but I hadn't, for some reason, I had missed all of that. And it was very late in the, in fact, they were already filming, whereas the other actors had been there for weeks and months in some cases, training, learning use of weapons and working on their Elvish and working on everything. And then they had begun shooting, but the character, the actor who was meant to play Strider, Aragorn, he was a very good actor, actually, but he was deemed to be too young because he was the same age as the Hobbits, basically, the actors playing the Hobbits. And it didn't quite work because Aragorn had to have this sort of, he had to be older, have lived a long life. He was had some Elvish blood, so he actually was, in actual years, far older than other humans that looked like him. And it didn't make sense. They needed someone that was older, simply. And so they, for whatever reason, they decided on me. I don't know what movies they saw or what made them think about it. Or maybe they didn't have many options at that point because it was so late in the game. Anyway, so I got the call and I initially resisted it. My son, Henry, who was 11 at the time, was familiar with Lord of the Rings. And when he got wind of, when I hung up the phone, he said, is that what I think it is? And he said, you should do it. I said, it's a very long commitment. And really, I always wanted, it's a team sport, making movies, and everybody has to contribute. And I think I would be at a disadvantage. I don't know this story. They've been there a while. I don't know. They should find an actor who knows Tolkien, and I don't know. It just didn't seem right, but I thought about it. He was insistent. And then I thought, it sounds intriguing. three movies, shoot them all at the same time. It sounds like a big New Zealand. That could be interesting. I don't know. So I decided to go for it. And obviously, I'm glad I did because it opened many doors. Not the movie itself, although it did teach me a lot of things, but the success that the movies had, and obviously allowed me to work with people like Cronenberg and others. And when I was on the plane, I went out and bought this book quickly. It was huge. It looked like the New York City telephone book, massive thing. And on the plane, this long 13-hour flight, and I didn't sleep. I just started reading it, looking at it. And I thought, what is this? I have no idea. But then I got a little ways into it, and I started to recognize, and I went to look at the appendices and story of Arwen and Aragorn. I know this stuff. I know where this comes from. I know because I've been raised with
Epic
Nordic
poems and myth,
mythology,
right, a mythology.
saga, a certain amount of Celtic stories and mythology as well. And so these things were familiar. There were certain archetypes that I was familiar with, whether it was the Volsunga saga or Njal saga or even Wagnerian mythos. I could see, okay, I see where they're taking this from. Now I'm And so I calmed down. I thought, well, this is intriguing. I see what the sources are. And so as soon as I got to Wellington, I did go to a bookstore. I said, I didn't realize this until I started reading the book. So I went out and got a copy of Volsunga saga and a few other things. I had very little time to prep. So I just immersed myself. And it was a great film school in a way for everyone involved, if you chose to look at it that way. To me, the most memorable thing about the experience of shooting those movies with Peter Jackson was the actual making of them. The way that New Zealanders, which by and large made up most of the crew, how they, under Peter Jackson's direction, found ingenious ways to troubleshoot, to solve problems on a daily basis, big ones, little ones. This has not been done. Well, we can do it. Let's just give it a try, or let's make up a new way to shoot something, that hasn't been done before. Who cares? There was this pioneer spirit that they had, never to be repeated in quite the same way, because now these crew members are schooled and have had many experiences. Now there is this big film industry there, right? At the time, there had been not just Peter Jackson, but Jeff Murphy and other filmmakers. There had been a history of making movies in New Zealand, but nothing on that scale. And so a lot of this hundreds of people in this crew were inexperienced. Some of them had very little or no experience. They'd done some TV work, commercials, a little bit of film work, student films, but they learned on the job along with all the rest of us. And that was the most fascinating thing about it. Just how you can solve problems, how you prepare, the care, the obsession of each department, and in particular, two artists who had illustrated the most well-known version of Lord of the Rings, John Howe, Canadian, I think. John Howe and Alan Lee. Maybe he's not Canadian, John Howe. I have to look it up. Anyway, Alan Lee's English. And those two were there. And there was a workshop. And their drawings, their illustrations, which are beautiful in the Lord of the Rings books, they were designing the sets for Rivendell and Lothlórien and so forth. And it was fantastic to watch all of that happening, all these workshops. And I was constantly zipping around and seeing what they were doing. And you were welcome to walk in. There was a Weta workshop. And I would say, well, this sword, and this looks like a Nordic. You go, yes, it's a combination of taken from this century and then the English style of this. And everything was referenced, everything, there was a reason for everything. Meticulous care with everything, even the background players, their costumes, the buttons on their tunic, everything. I don't think that'll ever happen again on that scale. It was just a remarkable, huge workshop slash film school, I guess.
That's amazing. You really do sense, and it comes through in some of the special features on the discs, that at no point at any time would you have a scenic designer or an art director say, it looks that way because I feel like it. There's always thought and care and a reason. And the other thing about a production like that, except that there is no production like that, really, it's one of a kind, is from Peter Jackson's point of view, it must have seemed like organizing a military campaign, an army with masses of people in front and behind the camera, huge amounts of green screen work, stunts all spread over a long period of time, lots of different locations in and out of the studio. Did you find it hard to maintain a sense of focus and also continuity in your character over all of those different sort of divides? And did you also find it challenging to maintain the kind of the intensity and intimacy of your relationship with the other characters? Because The Lord of the Rings as a book, because it comes from epics, the characters can be a little one-dimensional because they're not really conceived in 20th century fully fleshed human being terms. But in the film, they really do come to life, and you had to make that happen.
As anybody who's read the books knows, the Aragorn in Peter Jackson's trilogy speaks much less than he does in the books. But I think in most everything he did with the trilogy, what satisfied fans, Tolkien fans, by and large, I think, is that he was fairly faithful to the spirit of the stories, and they were ingenious in using the appendices, and it was a really good adaptation. You had to be on your toes. We were shooting three stories and jumping around from story to story on a daily basis sometimes. So you had to work hard to keep your own continuity and be conscious of where you were in the overall story at all times. You always should. And it was a little bit more of a task, I found, in Lord of the Rings. But I welcomed that. I liked the sort of jigsaw puzzle of it as we were putting together the story. And also, there were many units shooting. Towards the end, at one point, I think there were seven different film units with different directors. Big important things, usually it was Peter Jackson, but not always, directing me on the set. I worked with all kinds of directors on that movie. I counted up my days, and I think it was only around 28 or 30% of my time I was actually directed by Peter Jackson. But he was essentially always directing because he had satellite hookups. He had a bank of screens where he would, wherever he was shooting, day or night, he would be watching everything that everybody else was doing. And then he would call on the phone and say, no, I'd like you to do another take, but make this alteration.
Right.
So it was a giant enterprise. It was incredible how he got that done. But so each unit, you'd have a different person keeping track of continuity. It wasn't always the main script supervisor being, who was Victoria Sullivan, an Australian woman. So, it was a giant enterprise, but I enjoyed watching the collaborative aspect, and this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, the way that the whole crew felt involved in the story, even in this big sprawling enterprise, which was telling The Lord of the Rings on film. It was still like any small independent film thing where the crew was rolled their sleeves up and they were needed to participate. It wasn't just another job, but the spirit of it, that sort of pioneering spirit, and yeah, let's fix it. We'll figure out a way. It felt like a giant indie film, a giant budgeted indie film or a student film in some ways, where there was experimentation, there was improvisation, just to solve problems on a daily basis.
Right, which is where Peter Jackson really started. And knowing that the Tolkien books were really precious to millions of readers, and in the credits, the Tolkien Society members, I mean, those credits go on longer than any credits in human history. I have to imagine that once you became aware, and once Peter Jackson, I'm sure, grew up being aware, that there must have been a real sense of responsibility, like there is going to be one chance to do this ever, so we can't muff it. And I think even I read somewhere that Christopher Lee was a super Tolkien fan who read the books every single year from the time they were published. Yeah. Which is remarkable.
I got to be quite close to him. And after we shot that movie, any time I went through London, I always went to his house and we spent a couple hours talking. And he had a connect. His wife was Danish, and I got along with her as well. And I remember the Two Towers, the second movie, premiere in Copenhagen. Everybody was sent off to where they could help. And I was sent to South America once I realized I spoke Spanish because I could do the press there, and Mexico and Spain. But also Scandinavia, the languages also. And I remember that Christopher Lee and I were at the premiere for The Two Towers, which the Queen came to. And he knew the Queen personally, of course he did. And that was a great experience, but I really enjoyed working with him. He knew more about Tolkien's work than Tolkien probably did.
Yeah, and it must have been a real treat, and in a way of indication, as someone who's spent much of his life doing the lowest of low-budget films, to be basically in this super Rolls-Royce, this Bugatti of productions, and to look great and have enough takes and all the rest of it. Did you have a sense when you were in front of the camera how it was all going to look and feel when it was done. That must have been challenging with the amount of process work that went into the film.
Right. Well, there was enough that was really there. I'm thinking the incredible sets for Rivendell, for Lothlorien.
It's spectacular.
Helm's Deep. And the natural places that we were working in where it wasn't green screen, the beach forests on the South Island, the mountains, the snowy high mountain landscapes, and all these places we filmed in that were real, plus the sets that were built on the sound stages, forests, you know, Fangorn Forest, all kinds of things. I saw enough that you could see this is going to be extraordinary. It's going to be really amazing. I knew it would look great. And so having seen all those things, when we did do green screen work, let's say the Caves of Moria, for example, would be a good example of that. You knew that what he was very open about. It. He would show us what it was going to look like, the sort of previs kind of examples of what we were going to end up being in. It was very clear that this was going to be extraordinary in visual terms, what people were going to get eventually. But what nobody knew at the time we were making them was how much of an impact they would have. Yes, Tolkien book fans would probably be appreciated, but beyond that, who knows? And I remember their first public showing of anything to the media or anyone else was at the 2001 Cannes Film Festival. And we were invited there to do a couple of days of press to warm people up to the idea that these are the people involved in this project, mostly not known actors, other than Liv Tyler and to some degree, but more in theater at that time, Ian McKellen, Cate Blanchett to some degree, but other than that, Hugo Weaving. But it was mostly unknowns and to the public at large. And so they had us there to do some interviews, and they showed 20 odd minutes of cut footage from the first movie to the media. And it was the heart of that footage, I think, was the Caves of Moria. And that just blew people's minds, the music, the whole. And it was a really, that was smart. They did a great job and people got very excited. But I remember being on some rooftop of some hotel, sort of a cocktail thing at the end of a day of doing interviews. And there were some producers there and some of the people that had made the movie. And people were talking and one of the producers said, yeah, our big concern is Asia. In the West, yes, people know Tolkien, but in Asia, he's unknown. Japan's an important market and other Asian countries. And they don't know anything about Tolkien. I said, I don't think you have to worry at all because a lot of these things, for example, just take the elves and their traditions, their costumes, their philosophy. It's akin to, there's something universal there. It's not far off the samurai code of ethics and visually fighting. I think that there are so many universal aspects to this story, I don't think you're going to have any problem. I think that you'll have young people in Asia will love this movie. But nobody knew. It was a big gamble. And really, when they put out the first movie, they did everything they could to polish that and make it as good as it could be. And when that movie came out, had it not been a huge box office hit globally, and having spent so much money making this trilogy, if it had been a sort of a dud, or I don't know that the second and third movie would have, they would have allowed Peter Jackson the time and money to reshoot and perfect that.
Yeah.
Who knows if it would have even gone, it might have been a straight to video situation if it had not done well, the first one. Fortunately, it really struck a chord and people identified with it and it became a tradition for 3 years of, it's almost Christmas time. That means it's the new Lord of the Rings movies coming out.
Right.
You know, which then Harry Potter was doing the same thing. And that has become the trademark approach from the big studios to some degree. But there was nothing like Lord of the Rings before it. It influenced a lot of movies since in the fantasy genre.
What were some of the greatest physical challenges? Was it the swordsmanship, weather, injuries, doing your own stunts? And did you derive anything special from the amount of horse time that you had?
I grew up with horses in Argentina, and so I liked them. And I had a great time doing that. There's a couple of horses I ride in the movie. And well, sometimes it was substitute lookalike ones, depending on what location we were in. But yeah, I enjoyed all the landscapes. I know some of the more trying things for the production were the changes in weather and sudden unexpected snowstorms or inundations because of the flooding and because of heavy rains. Some days in summer it was very hot with the outfits we were wearing. There were injuries along the way. A lot of things happened. It's a year and a half straight shooting and then reshoots for months each year for another 3 years. There were people that got together, that met, that married, that then got divorced. They had children. There were people that had horrible injuries. I remember one stuntman, Australian guy, just had his leg just really shattered. And he went away back to Melbourne for 6 months or so and rebuilt it, came back, and then was doing high falls off castle walls in the last couple of months and was right back at it. So it was such a long process that many things happened. There wasn't anything that I felt was so difficult. As I say, the general atmosphere, the general approach there from everyone seemed to be about problem solving.
I guess I have to ask, in which did you get more banged up, that or the bathhouse scene in Eastern Promises?
Eastern Promises, I got pretty banged up, I have to say. I mean, I was very bruised and it took longer. The next day we had to, after shooting that whole scene, we had to do some pickup shots. And it took them a lot longer to cover all the bruises that I had from the day before than it did to put all of those tattoos on.
All the tattoos, you're right.
But I did falling off horses or losing a tooth or, you know, breaking a couple toes. Things happen along the way in Lord of the Rings too, but it was spread out. And a lot of other people had problems and injuries and got ill and had family problems and relationship problems.
Yeah.
It was like a huge traveling circus.
Well, friends, that brings us to the end of part one of our conversation with Viggo Mortensen. Please join us next week for part two as Viggo discusses all the incredible creative places that life has taken him after Lord of the Rings. I know you won't want to miss it. Please join us then. And once again, I'm Brian Levine for The Gould Standard.